谢大家回谢北北时间，我是大叔桑。
我是大叔甲。
呀，今天很高兴，有机会跟一个老朋友 Bo Bi Go 聊一下。那这个 Bo 大家在台湾可能跟他不熟啦，可是，在科技界，在矽谷，他还算是个蛮有名的咖这样子。那他是从非常技术的角度出身这样子，他在科技界是 AR 跟 VR 的祖师之一。那 VR 是 Virtual Reality，AR 是 Augmented Reality，所以很多什么现在可能有人在玩那个不同的 Game 啦、Oculus 等等等等那些东西。其实我认他十几不到20年，可是十几年了。那时候都还没有时候，他已经这很多背后的东西都是他发展出来的。然后所以那当然就说，除了技术上很强，当然他现在也是阿北等级的，所以就是一路走过来，从发展技术一直到现在是这个当这个经理哦，就是台湾都听过的，他说不能讲的那几家公司，你想得到的、想不到，
是的，
他都在里面，都蛮大的，所以觉得很棒，就是有因为我们之前有跟那个学院长聊过，所以我们就是那个所谓的 bi-coastal，就是这个太平洋东岸跟太平洋西岸的一些讨论这样子，然后 anyway，他这个人也很有趣，他其实想当年是，我觉得他比较有趣的是，他想当年是在美国军方，他是个大头兵，然后他是会讲阿拉伯文的，所以他是就是一个很厉害的人这样子，是，那所以大叔讲，你觉得呢？
我觉得这个两位跟邱院长还有 BO 两位都是很有实务经验的，就是当然在那个学术界里面都有一些背景，但是很多实务经验，我觉得很值得大家等一下我们来一起跟 BO 聊一聊。那我们就现在进入节目喽。Hi, this is your favorite uncle, Uncle Jia. We have a very honored guest today coming all the way from the US, Bo. Bo, would you like to say hi to our listeners?
Hey, everybody. It's really nice to meet you.
Excellent. So, Uncle San, what are we going to talk about today?
Well, I mean, we already sort of gave a little bit of introduction about Bo, and he's the man. And I think when it comes to innovation, the big question, the elephant in the room, as it were, is always, if innovation walks into the room, would you recognize it? So I think Bo, my very first question is, I'm sure, people pitch you ideas, midnight you dream of something. There are a thousand things you can do, but how do you pick the right one to, how do you bet on the right project?
Well, that's a great question. Really appreciate it. First of all, I just want to thank you, uncles, for having me on the show. It's really an honor, and it's a pleasure to just be part of this global community. So thank you very much. But I think that's a great question, is what is innovation? How can you know what's the right thing to do? And of course, it is a risk-oriented kind of investment. When you decide to pursue something that looks innovative, there's risk involved in whether that's going to pay off or not. So you want to be as careful as possible, but there's no way to predict it perfectly with perfect accuracy,
Of
right?
course, of
And
course.
I know even just from my own experience as a researcher and a research manager, there have been times when I get super excited about an idea and it's all I can think about for weeks, maybe. And then at some point, you have to face some realities about whether your idea going to face insurmountable hurdles. Not usually on the technical side. Usually technical innovators have a good idea of whether something's feasible or not, but a lot of times business constraints just make something impractical. And maybe we should dive into that more and unpack it more, because I think there's other things to say about that. But business constraints can make it impractical. Also, I see examples where business, or maybe I should say more like global economic conditions, make an idea very viable. And I think a good example of that is all of this buzz around autonomous vehicles. You know, people are all excited about autonomous vehicles, but it's not just the autonomy, right? It's the battery technologies, it's the computer vision capabilities, it's the need to do more with electric generated vehicles than with gas, you know, pollution emission kinds of motors. All of these are converging in a way that make autonomous vehicles, or maybe we don't go all the way to autonomy, just electric vehicles, much more viable than they would have been, you know, 10 years ago or 15 years ago when the visions really started being tested. So just one example. Anyway, I know I didn't answer your question thoroughly or directly, but that's partly because it's just a multifaceted kind of problem, and you just have to work through the different issues around
it. Right. Well, I mean, you know, just kind of follow up, I think your points are very well taken. I mean, if I may, I mean, what you're saying to me is, you know, I mean, if you're lucky, you come to the tipping point, and if you are even luckier, you be the one tipping it over, and then you look like the hero, right? with that said, I mean, you know, I think what you just mentioned earlier is like, you know, sometimes you get obsessed with the idea for weeks. I think one obviously speaks to the passion, but the flip side of it is like, well, you know, so for example, how do you go about, or you know, a researcher come to you and say, I have this great idea, how do you push the researcher on like identifying the non-technical issues?
Oh, that's excellent. That's really challenging, partly because, you know, researchers, generally innovators, walk around with this philosophy that they're going to change the world. So even if you present them with a hard reality of the practical world, they're not going to accept that as enough of evidence to not go forward, right? Also within research, you know, one of the other cultural memes that we carry around is that a test for a great idea is to have a lot of people tell you it's a bad idea, right? So we kind of thrive on that negative feedback, you know, people say, oh, that's never going to work. You know, we can't sell that, or, you know, we'll get whatever the business problems are. That just emboldens a researcher. So as a manager, what I have to do is carry them through their own thought process about whether something can work or not. You know, don't just say it can't work and here's why. I have to ask them questions, you know. For example, well, you know, how long would it take to put that into a product? How big of a team would need to work out all the edge cases? What are we going to do about the regulatory issues? Because this is a sensitive area. You know, maybe it's privacy, maybe it's health, you know. You just have to walk through that whole scenario with the research team to either have them convince themselves it's not viable, or I sometimes come away thinking, this could work. And I know many examples, but please.
So, Bo, obviously you have a filtering system, so you talk about the technology side of it and sort of the commercial side of it. So that's your filtering system. If something does go through your filter, how do you work with your innovators to track progress? Because as you come along, your job is to devote more and more resources to make sure it's a success. Right, at what point do you kind of say, boy, I'm going to take it all the way to the board, or I'm going to just kill it now before it becomes a money sink? What do you do?
Right. Well, that kind of sometimes depends on the researcher and the idea. You know, usually the researchers are so excited about something that you can't hold them back. You know, and that's a good thing. You want to encourage some of that, as long as they're meeting whatever pre-planned objectives you've all agreed to.
Right.
That's the first thing that they need to do. But then I tell teams that, you know, work on things on the side, create your seed corn of innovation ideas that we might launch into something bigger. And we share that information so that as I become aware of opportunities, I can feed the seed corn into those and vice versa. But, you know, the usually a very small amount of effort can de-risk the idea enough.
Mm-hmm.
It could be put in to test that technical feasibility at the most risky part of it. You know, maybe it's algorithmic part, if we're talking software, maybe it's a particular performance metric that a piece of hardware needs to achieve in order to make the idea viable. So we'll, you know, let the team put that in on the side, and if it looks promising, then maybe take it up for further resourcing to incubate it further. So you have to kind of go in stages like that, and at each stage, you know, there's sometimes we have a defined process where there is a yes, no decision about whether to go to the next step or not. Most often the actual decision is kind of mushy. It's like, we might decide not to invest in the whole plan, but we'll put a little more in to try to test out a sidetrack that has emerged during the course of the research. And it's all these branches that just, you just need to let run, but not necessarily waste everybody's time, but let multiple branches run so that they can reconverge when opportunities are right, when the resource opportunity arises, you know?
Right. Well, you know, I mean, if I may just sort of asking a sort of a softer question, but it probably is a little bit more tricky to answer too, which is, you know, obviously this whole process you describe is nebulous, I guess that's the word. And that being the case, I assume, you know, you as the manager, as the leader, the whole organization or the team, you need to have a lot of credibility, right? You know, because ultimately somebody needs to make a decision. So I guess my question is that, you know, how do you, because, you know, it's innovation, so it by definition is not something that you would know as much as a researcher, right? You know, so how does attention managed?
Yeah, let me, there are two different points I want to make. One is, I realize as I've been talking, the scenarios I've painted have been a lot about sort of the bottoms up innovation, where the researchers, the individual researchers have an idea, or maybe it comes out of a research community, you know, the academic community or something, and they want to percolate that up. That is a common model for innovation. It's very frequent. And we and everybody in the industry also follow more of a top-down approach, where we've got customers or business leaders who are saying, hey, we need some advances in a particular category. And I don't know what those are because I'm not the technical expert. So I need your research team to look at that and see what we can streamline and adapt and make better. And both of those approaches need to occur because the research teams also need to know what problems they should tackle, right? So that was one point I wanted to make. Though I think getting back to your question about, you know, how to manage the individuals in the team and give them comfort about pursuing ideas. What's important is not that, I think it's not necessary that their manager be seen to agree with them, but that their manager be seen to care about success. And you have to agree on success. So here's the challenge. Sometimes researchers, they come from graduate school, they come from academia, and they think of success in terms of publications, because how professors, professors are measured on that. But a business research team needs to focus on business outcomes, right? It's not always a revenue story, but 80% of success in business needs to be about revenue. There's side effects too, you know, marketing and public relations and educating society about some new technologies. Those all have business value too, but they're sort of side effects, right? So again, you have to get the team to agree on what we're going to call success. And then the manager just has to be seen as a genuine coach and someone who genuinely cares about the success of the individuals or the team. So it's fine to challenge them. It's fine to push them, as long as it's all in the name of this success that we have previously agreed to. Now, where you get run into problems though, is sometimes individuals aren't completely bought into the same success story. Mm-hmm. And that's okay. We're all humans. But you just need to revisit it over and over, develop a relationship with each other and just share that vested interest and common vision.
It is a process.
It's a process, right? Yeah. You can't just drop into an organization and define, though, a formal process, right? And I know that's not what you meant, but just to comment on it, you can't just come in and define our innovation process. Mm-hmm. Now, having said that, I think it's great to have a process because it gives everybody a framework around which they can talk about where they are in the process for each project, you know? Mm-hmm. And it gives people a theoretical model of how to make progress. But you can't depend on a process to be successful.
Of course, understand. Yeah. And you know, I think a sort of a related question. Oh, thank you for sharing sort of your experiences managing, obviously, your team and, you know, with your peers, but especially in a corporate context, how do you manage upward, right? Because, you know, a lot of, at least my personal experiences, you know, my team don't buy the vision, not necessarily because they don't buy in what I say, or you know, they believe what I know what I'm doing, but, you know, it's like, yeah, but a CEO is, you know, going the wrong direction.
Yeah. Well, managing up is really important. I'll tell you this. And I think that's another one too, where you've got to persuade the executives or whoever your customers are. Maybe it's investors if you're at a startup. Maybe it's the government agency that's funding you. You know, whoever your customers are, they have to believe that you're pursuing a successful outcome. And again, you have to agree on what that means. So, you know, if you're in a corporation and you're working in a corporate owned research lab, presumably you want to influence the products or the services that company is providing to the market, right? So you need to communicate the milestone achievements of the research team in those terms, in terms of the bottom line for the company. You know, for a government agency, they also usually have some particular objective that they're contracting the work for, but then they have these side effects they want to educate the workforce, or they want to encourage some type of economic development in a certain category. So again, you need to communicate the outcomes of the research in those terms, in the terms that the investor cares about. And I'd say too, you want to do that frequently. Is the thing. Not just wait. You know, that's just everybody likes to kind of be left alone, right?
Yes,
that causes distrust, though.
Absolutely,
decision makers, right? They're like, oh, I let these guys go for 6 months. What do they have to show for it? Mm-hmm. You don't want to be in that position. You want to communicate very regularly, so that everybody knows what kind of progress you're making, what your plans are, what the decision points are. And that way, you know, 6 months goes by and then a decision maker can know what went into it and why you are where you are, instead of just wondering why they spent all this money with no output.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like the idea that you brought up just now, is defining success, if you will, upfront, so everybody could agree to, all the major constituent groups could agree to, including your team, the shareholders, the CEO, the government agencies and whatnot. I think somebody once called it a pre-mortem rather than, as opposed to a post-mortem. So once you agree to it upfront, you know, the objectives are very clear. Now, sometimes things change and then, you know, you end up having to sort of quote unquote, having to move the goalpost. How do you manage that? I mean, if things change and then you already define these successes, and if you had to go back and revise or, you know, sort of tinker with those predefined successes, what's the communication process? How do you manage that process?
That's very common, very common scenario. And I think it's analogous to when you write a paper, or if you write an article for something, you have a plan in mind of how you're going to write it, what your outline is, and you start putting it on paper, but you'll see as you go that, oh, that wasn't a good idea. I need to cut that paragraph. And you have to just be willing to lose it. You've wasted the time you put into that paragraph, but you're going to have a better outcome if you can just you know, cut your costs.
Right.
So the other thing is too, a lot of researchers are worried about pre-committing on what they'll achieve because they're going to say, look, this is research. I don't really know if it's going to work.
Right.
I have a great idea and high confidence, but until I do it, I can't know for sure.
Right.
So, so you have to give it, them comfort and the investors comfort to say that, look, this is a plan, but it's not a contract. You know, people are still making progress, even if we fall short. So that's one thing. Everybody has to acknowledge that. And then, though, as you proceed and you run into a dead end or find out that you can't test whatever theory you had put in the plan for because you don't have the resources or the resources aren't sufficient, you could modify the plan. And I think what's important there is just, again, communication. You know, talk to the investors and say, you know, here's what we learned, you know, and here's why we think what we'd initially planned needs to diverge. And, you know, everybody in these rooms are reasonable humans, right? And they're going to understand the need. And if they disagree with you, gives them an opportunity to push back. And they might be right too. They might have a good point that, oh, we could do it with the resources we have if we dropped some other thing perhaps or spent a little extra time on it.
Yeah, it's so I'd like to sort of approach the question from a slightly different dimension. So far we've been talking about in the context of single project, right? You know, how do we make it better and do all that, but you know, again, you know, in any research setting, especially as a manager, you have to deal with the portfolios of projects.
That's right.
And there's only 24 hours in a day, and there's only X amount of dollars you can spend on the entire portfolio. So how do you figure out, like, you know, where do resources go?
That's a great question. Is it okay if I contradict myself?
Oh, no. Hey, I do that all the time.
You know, plans are meant to be revised, right? Yeah.
Well, here's the contradiction I want to say is that I think a successful team is one that's focused, that focuses on a category, at least, if not one single project. And that way they can use lessons from other projects to help inform new projects, right? However, I think portfolio is necessary in order to juggle resources. You have to have a sufficient number of projects and staff so that as your project proceeds, you could take skills from one sub project and put it into another project for a short time, you know? And research management involves a lot of juggling of these skills for short durations. Unlike, you know, product management, usually it also has that, but it's more staged, it's more formalized about what skills you need at different points in the product production stream, right? But with research, it's not always as cut and dry. It hasn't been done before, or you just don't have the exact right skills, but you've got something close in one of your staff members. So you'll ask that person, you know, hey, could you come and help out on this project for 3 months, 6 months, whatever it's going to take. And, you know, here's why it's exciting. You know, that's also the manager's job is
to sell them.
This is why it's exciting. You know, if that project is successful, it's going to change X and Y. And besides, then you'll get to work with so-and-so, you know, smart people like to work with other smart people, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. So
be on the winning team.
Yeah. So, so you got to have focus and yet a large enough portfolio to be able to shift resources, on kind of an ad hoc basis, depending on the needs of the project as it arises.
I mean, you know, I think in many ways, being an uncle myself, this is very comforting to know, because a lot of this is tactile experience. You know, I'm not going to get replaced. This is a true skill.
Yeah, that's right.
And you know, so sort of pushing the timeline further, you know, innovation innovative idea, the project going well, and, you know, sort of the research part is sort of almost not it's never done, but, you know, I mean, it's good enough. So how do you transition from, you know, sort of pure research to development and commercialization? Because I think a lot of projects I'm aware of, that's actually where it fails. Just like the handoff is just not right.
Right. Well, that's another one. There's a variety of different approaches to it, and it depends on both what the technology is and the people involved. Mm-hmm. And, you know, because some researchers, they love taking their idea all the way to commercialization. Mm-hmm. You know, they enjoy that whole journey through those things. Mm-hmm. Other researchers, they maybe specialize in a particular technical category that is only necessary at a short phase, say during an innovation project. Mm-hmm. And they want to stay, you know, and also they may see that as a career category that they want to pursue. You know, they want to become well known in the research community. Mm-hmm. So that means they need to stay in research. They want to have the opportunity to publish some of their results so they can build up their reputation. That's harder to do in product teams usually, because they need to focus more on release dates and service support and responding to customer requests for updates and things like that. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But so I'm just sort of painting the two extremes of the type of researcher that you might have. And there's everybody in the middle between those two extremes as well. What I think is the key to success, though, is to have a customer. You don't necessarily have to have the customer there to write the check, but you have to have the vision of who's going to buy this and have the team be excited about making that customer happy with the outcome. And then that motivates people to put in what is needed in order to get the customer what they want. It also helps drive business decisions too about what we're going to keep in the product, what we're not going to keep in the product. You know, because the thing about technology is you could throw a bunch of extra stuff in there into your platform, for example, if you're developing a platform. But if you've got a customer who doesn't need all that stuff, you're going to waste your money putting it in there, right? So you need to have a customer who can help say what they are going to pay for and what they're not going to pay for. And that customer, again, could be a commercial customer, could be a government agency. It can be, you know, a research community, because even within the research community, you're sometimes creating tools and methodologies that others in the community are going to utilize. And those are a product of sorts within research as well.
Yeah, so it's a... And I think you know, our time is almost up, so I want to make sure I squeeze in this one. I believe this you know, Steve Jobs, obviously, you know, one of the heroes in Silicon Valley, and I think he said something to the effect of like he doesn't believe in consumer research. You know, he will tell you what you want, and I always find it so fascinating. And I think somebody explained to me what Steve Jobs was so good at is look at a larger context. You know, where we are and fighting, you know, he can smell the air and know where we're going next. So in the context, you know, because I can imagine, you know, just at a technical level, at a corporate level, at a product level, you can get so focused that you lose sight of the context. I mean, how do you make sure, you're on the right side of history, as it were?
Yeah, Apple's really a unique company within the tech industry. And I think, you know, Steve Jobs had many characteristics. And one of those is he could put himself in the role of the customer. You know, he could make decisions about what people would and wouldn't pay for in the products. And he could also, he could predict what they'd be excited about too, different, you know, user interface elements or different design tweaks and things like that. So he's, you know, he may be unique in that capability, especially within the tech industry, where a lot of us are very rational and we're thinking multidimensional about you know, what ifs and things like that. Mm-hmm. He's the kind of guy who would just kind of crystallize it mm-hmm. and, mm-hmm. you know, make mm-hmm. a decision. Now, you know, Steve's been gone for some time. Apple relies a lot on designers to do that kind mm-hmm. of thinking for them. Mm-hmm. And because they're creating something that doesn't exist in the market yet, mm-hmm. there's not an existing customer you can go solicit for input. Mm-hmm. So take design thinking and mm-hmm. use that to help you focus and predict what a customer would want in a in a new product that you're working on. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's for retail end user products, sure. but you can use similar methods for enterprise products mm-hmm, too. Mm-hmm, you know, imagine what the companies that you're going to sell to are going to need mm-hmm. and have some people create those business persona that you're going to sell to. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. Right. Right. Yeah, so, really so like how much time do you spend reading stuff, you know, other than just like, you know, very, you know, make sure you're pushing, managing, I mean, or do you have time to read at all?
Oh, yeah, no, I definitely do. I think it's tricky, though, because you get so many diverse opinions among mm-hmm. experts, right? Mm-hmm. So, again, I think Steve may have been unique in his ability to put himself in the role of a customer. Mm-hmm. That's what you kind of have to do is try to imagine you were an actual buyer for this product. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. If you don't know enough about the domain, though, the business domain or the retail domain, mm-hmm. you need to find people who represent that. You know, go out mm-hmm. and interview them, mm-hmm. collect some input, find out what their real problems are. Mm-hmm. You know, ask them to imagine this future with the product that you're envisioning. And if they had it, mm-hmm. what would change their lives for the better? Or maybe why wouldn't they use it? You know, do they mm-hmm. are they going to be bothered by having to recharge the battery every 3 hours, mm-hmm. or is there some data collection concern that mm-hmm. is going to prevent them from buying it? They might have some reservations that a technologist wouldn't predict themselves. So yeah, user right. experience research is really important.
I think I have one more minute, so I want to ask the last question. You know, in every organization that I've worked for before, there's always one project that never dies. So what's your one project that never dies, and how did you kill it?
I think that's great, because Uncle Son, didn't you ask me at the beginning of this, how do you decide what projects to kill?
Yeah,
there you go.
Yeah, but I think Uncle Ja, my experience has been that no idea really completely dies. Mm-hmm. You just put it aside for a little while mm-hmm. because you've got something that's even more valuable
right.
that's exciting
right.
you at any right. moment, you know? Mm-hmm. So for myself, I love using sensors to predict human behavior. And at some point, yeah, all of this vision of the future with, you know, digital twins of humans, not just mm-hmm. machines mm-hmm. that behave and act like us semi-autonomously. It's a very complicated future, but that's the direction that I'm really excited about seeing.
That's wonderful. You heard it here, folks. No ideas really die.
Wait, isn't it like the old soldier never dies kind of thing?
That's right.
Actually, on that point, I remember last week or any fairly recently, I read an announcement from MIT. They have a digital fabric that was made. And you know, with all the sensors and all that, so I think it's closer right. than what right. I thought is possible. Right. Yeah,
right. I think it's the kind of thing that'll never really be fully realized. So it makes it a great research problem to put one's career into. You know, it'll never be done.
You know, you cannot see Bo right now. He is literally salivating.
A true innovator.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. Well, so I think our time is up. I really appreciate your time, Bo, and I would love to have you come again and share more of your thoughts.
Well, thank you, Uncles, both very much. I really enjoyed the conversation. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
Wow, 非常感谢 Bo 跟我们分享这么多，就是 就是实战经验啦，就是矽谷归矽谷，可是你事情还是要做嘛，不是说因为就在矽谷就怎么样这样子，所以要怎么做呢？我觉得真的，当然还是那句话，我跟他是有点熟啦，所以他讲的，那我自己也在矽谷混过这样子。那我觉得很有趣的是说，如果大家有机会听到那个薛院长的那一集，就我们上一集，就是其实很明显的做事情，你不管是在矽谷，不管是在台湾，还是应该是什么地方，都是这样子，就所谓的 execution 啊，怎么一脚步这个一步一个脚印的这个概念，而不是哎呀，因为不能像大树上我自己这样，就是专门出一张嘴而已。这一件事情是
出一张嘴还是要出了，但是事情还是要做了。
是
对对，我觉得 Bo 讲的某种程度跟薛院长讲的是异曲同工啊，就是。这些有这么多经验等他们也看过这么多案例，有这么多实务经验，不管去学术跟动手做的角度，那其实他们讲的就是就是说，哦，这个可能真的就是没有所谓的一个 magic bullet，就是说很多事情就是要边做边调整，我觉得这对我来讲也是一个很大的启发。
然后还有另外一个，一方面可能有人会觉得比较沮丧的事情，可是我觉得其实从我角度是一个非常正面，那就是说找到一个真正好的技术，一个真正好的 killer app 还是那种东西，其实没有人知道，所以呢，我觉得你可以说这很沮丧，可是我听了我就很高兴，不会啊，那这样我连我都有机会，然后接下来就是你要怎么执行。那比执行，那我们就来比执行。这个我反而没有什么特别觉得那个，不是说执行容易啦，可是怎么是合理，什么是好的执行，反而是知道的啊。那当然知易行难嘛，这是有另外一件事情。
是。
然后我觉得还有另外一个很有趣的是，就听 Bo 讲，就是很明显的就是矽谷的语言，它的想象是。就是一个所谓全球，那当然不也不否认在矽谷的全球某种程度就是美国了，不过就是一个很大的这个机会，这个市场，我觉得这件事情也蛮值得，虽然我们在台湾，不过还是值得想想看，因为说实话以前美国真的有点远。现在美国是基本上就是手机的 Line 的按两下。所以美国已经不远了，或是全世界任何地方其实都不远了。
但是矽谷当然就是说过去十几二十甚至三十年也很多人想要复制矽谷，那其实矽谷有他自己的条件，然后我觉得可能这个每一个地方都要去考虑自己的条件，在复制的过程就是不是完全就是 copy exact， 其实很多事情它的主客观条件真的就是不一样。那还是回到一个计算的角度，就是说那你长处你的优劣势是什么，这个还是要算清楚，才有一个比较值得去走的一个路径，要不然就说，大家就是要就 copy 来 copy 去，那但是光是一个矽谷就是有UC Berkeley 跟 Stanford 两个大咖的学术大学在那边，那光是这样子就不太好 copy 了。
哎，我们有台大，
耶耶，我们有台青交，是的，
台青交没错，
是。
不过我觉得就是说，当然什么所谓 copy 矽谷还怎么样，那个比较是一个政策面的问题啦。那政策这边就政策归政策了。那我想，就是说如果以美国经验而言，说实话，其实美国很多地方也说我要变成矽谷，成功的也是非常少。
是。
所以不过还是回到一个因为创新还是那句话，就是我印象很深刻，当我还在矽谷的时候，当然因为我也是在新创公司解翻滚这样子，那第一件事情就是你开家公司的第一件事情就是要去租一个邮箱，你没听错，就是租一个，你那个地址要在 Palo Alto， 你那个电话号码要650 就是 Palo Alto 的区域号码、yeah. 可是你那办公室可以很远，那是另外一件事情所以当然这是一个游戏规则，可是我倒是觉得啦，就因为我们这个系列在讨论的是比较是创新这件事情，我倒是觉得就是应该你就是找一个合适的地方、啊、然后接下来就是当然还是回到那句话执行。那当然另外一个我觉得这是个人的观察啦，就是你最后特别是比较科技方面的创新，你最后要解决的是一个真正的问题。就是当你是解决一个真正的问题，你可能开始的时候是就全世界可能只有10000个人需要，可是再过几年会变100000，然后那当然也没有说就一定会做起来，可是反过来讲就是说当你解决的不是一个真正的问题的时候，其实就是不是个问题嘛。
从某个角度这就是资本主义的核心嘛，就是说你在、不管是也许不一定是高科技，但是你是一个提供的是一个服务，是帮别人解决一个问题。那大树上要不要讲一下当年 Internet 解决的什么问题？
哎呀，Internet 啊，这个是我觉得其实网络是一个很有趣的事情，就是说如果大家有如果有机会去看一下它的历史的话，网络是1960年代就已经开始有最原始版，当然
这么早
对，然后就是说一般我们这种凡人是1990年中的时候，如果大家年纪够大，记得那个 Netscape 啦、Yahoo 啊，就是
对
就是1990，所以它这中间30年到底在干嘛？所以第一个为什么需要网路，是美国军方要打战嘛、那就是他们因为打战，我想就有在看这个，就是第一个就是要把那个敌人的所有的沟通的这些线全部剪掉哦，把它打坏啊。那所以美国军方专门是这个是专家啦啊，那他们也会想说，那如果人家来攻击我们的沟通怎么办？所以网络要解决的问题，其实你有去看，就是当 A 到 B 的线被剪掉的时候，我怎么透过 A 到 C 到 D 再接到 B？哦、就是怎么绕过去，它其实要解决是这个问题、然后之后才会有各式各样的，所以就是那个时候真的也没有人，也因为我真的有认识走过网络的那些大前辈们，然后他们说没有，我们当初要解决问题不是你们现在那种什么什么什么盗版啊什么的那个，那是不同的事情。
没错，所以当初的 killer app 到最后衍生出更多的 killer app， 对不对？
是那所以就说这个，我们其实也先预报一下，我们接下来有跟另外一个也是创新相关的一个专家，就是它里面有个点，就是说你要是真的解决一个真正的问题，你只要活得够久的话，都是可以发的，所以我就更充满信心的，
耶、yeah, ，更多动力，身体要照顾好，
没错呀。Yeah, 好，那个希望大家今天觉得 Bo 的讨论很有趣。那当然了，我们这个节目如果没有背后很厉害的团队是做不出来的，所以第一个要先感谢的是 Oliver， 他除了做其他东西之外，这一季的音乐也都是他选的。
我们当然也要感谢我们自己的团队、Ariel、Hannah 跟 Lalisa、
Oliver 也是我们自己的团队啊。
哦，对，都是自己的团队，因为当然Oliver 刚才被挑出来是因为他选了我们的音乐。
而且他又高又帅，我先讲一下。
哦、oh, ，OK，、
是
请直接发 email， 我们都有在读。
是那个，所以我们下一集我们这个换个口味，我们找到一个专门分析中国内政的高手，然后呢，我们叫他高球哥。那也希望大家期待。那如果大家喜欢谢北的时间，请记得在您聆听的平台上订阅、打5颗星、按赞与留言。
这段疫情里，大家要好好照顾自己跟身边的人。我们也祝福大家平安健康。
谢谢，拜拜，
拜拜。